Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call. Now, we have over 665 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Bahrain, Canada, Ireland, Kenya, South Africa, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. Today's program is has been funded by a number of different supporters. I'm going to let you know who all is supporting the program today. This program was made possible by a charitable contribution from Bayer Healthcare. This activity is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen. This program was made possible by an educational grant from Eli Lilly and Company. We really want to thank the industry for their collaborative support of our program today. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all of our collaborating organizations as resources for you. There also is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing, and there is an evaluation form. And we ask all of you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. Because when you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the workshops and program that you would like us to offer going forward? And indeed, we're entering a new year. Next year is 2013. We're planning many new programs, and your suggestions will really help to make these programs most relevant to meet your needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al B. Benson III. And Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine. He's Associate Director for Clinical Investigations, the Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. Dr. Benson is going to address an overview of colorectal cancer, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and he's also going to address treating metastatic colorectal cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to join everyone today to discuss a very important topic. First of all, colorectal cancer is one of the most common cancers in the United States and around the world. And therefore, it has been the focus of screening programs with screening, such as the use of colonoscopy. We can detect polyps before they may transform into a cancer, and it is a good opportunity to try to diagnose an early cancer before it can spread. So screening programs are critical across populations around the world. In general, about 80% of people who present with an actual colon cancer can undergo successful surgery. But there are about 20% of people at the time of their initial diagnosis who already have metastatic disease, which means that the cancer from the colon has spread to other organs, the most common sites of spread being the liver and lung. There have been a number of developments through the years to affect the appropriate treatment for people with colon cancer. So just briefly, for those individuals who've undergone successful surgery for their colon cancer and have no other evidence of disease by, say, a CAT scan, there are individuals who still have risk for what we refer to as micrometastatic disease. This is disease we can't see by any of our x-rays, but we're concerned that cells may exist. And so for some individuals, we offer chemotherapy after surgery, and the most typical regimen includes two drugs, both chemotherapy drugs. One is referred to as oxaliplatin, the other is 5-FU. There is also an oral version of 5-FU referred to as capecitabine, and that is also sometimes used with oxaliplatin. And by giving this therapy, we have shown that we can destroy residual tumor cells and improve the outcome for people who have undergone successful surgery initially. Even with successful surgery and with the use of chemotherapy after surgery, the term for that approach is called adjuvant therapy. Unfortunately, there are people who over time may progress from their original cancer, meaning that there were still cells that were present and grew over time. The greatest risk of the development of metastatic disease after successful surgery falls within the first 2 to 3 years, and that's why after surgery and chemotherapy, we carefully follow people, particularly for 2 to 3 years. For those who have developed disease that has spread to other areas, there's also been tremendous progress made. For over 50 years, the only drug we had available was 5-FU. It's still an important drug. We use 5-FU not only in many of our colorectal cancer regimens, but for other cancers also. But particularly over the last decade, there has been quite rapid development of new agents. So there have been 3 chemotherapy agents that are now routinely used. One is the capecitabine, which is the oral 5-FU I mentioned, and then there are 2 other chemotherapy drugs, irinotecan and oxaliplatin, which I mentioned we often give to people after successful surgery. In addition, there are 5 new drugs, which we refer to not as chemotherapy, but they are so-called targeted drugs because they are designed to attack a given biologic pathway within the tumor. And this type of approach where we identify a biological target is often referred to as personalized medicine or precision medicine, where we try to design drugs that will address a particular pathway. In colorectal cancer, 2 of these 5 drugs affect a pathway known as the EGFR pathway, and we have recognized that there is a genetic change within tumors referred to as KRAS. And for about 60% of people with what's called a KRAS tumor genetic profile, these are individuals who are most likely to benefit from these 2 anti-EGFR drugs referred to as cetuximab and panitumumab. So doing this particular tumor test has become standard and very important in helping design a treatment strategy. In addition, there are 3 other drugs which have a different targeted pathway referred to as the anti-VEGF or anti-angiogenesis pathways. One is bevacizumab, and just this year, the FDA approved 2 additional drugs referred to as aflibercept and regorafenib, which have expanded available agents for people with metastatic disease. With the development of these new drugs, what we've seen is that people often can have quite impressive tumor shrinkage, and that has led to the concept that more patients, even if they have isolated spread to their liver or to the lung, they may actually benefit from surgical removal of these metastatic deposits, which we have shown through a number of different medical series has improved the ability to control the disease. So what we now carefully monitor is when we give these newer combination therapies, particularly for people with very isolated, small numbers of metastatic lesions in the liver in particular, to see if we get good shrinkage and if these individuals can go on to surgery. And this is now a strategy that is routinely employed around the world and is considered an advancement. I wish I could say that everyone could undergo that surgery. It's not true. It's only a subset of patients, but it is important to recognize that. So in terms of these new therapies, this has offered many opportunities for people to receive treatment over a substantially longer period of time and therefore enjoy much better control of their disease for much longer. And there actually has been an analysis of people who received all three of the chemotherapy drugs that I mentioned, irinotecan, 5-FU or capecitabine, and oxaliplatin. And what has been demonstrated is that those individuals who over time can receive all three drugs, not at once, but in sequence as the disease is monitored, those are the individuals who have the best improvement in response rate. And now with the addition of these so-called targeted therapies, such as cetuximab, bevacizumab, and so forth, what I mentioned, usually given in combination with chemotherapy, people are also enjoying further improvement in control of their disease. And what this has led to is a concept called the continuum of care for metastatic colorectal cancer. And what that means is that there are now multiple treatment options available to manage the disease. There is a direct correlation between how well we control the disease and the length of time we can control the disease and the number of opportunities we have over time to use these treatments for an individual patient. In addition, the continuum of care requires that we pay close attention to the risk of side effects and that we make appropriate adjustments if side effects develop, and certainly to make efforts to control any side effects. And by doing this more individualized treatment approach, we feel that overall people have better quality of life and overall better outcome. Now, what also developed this year were three very important clinical trials that have enhanced treatment opportunities for patients. One is, I mentioned the combination of chemotherapy and bevacizumab, and one of the questions was, if a person has evidence of growth of their disease by CAT scan, for example, on a chemotherapy approach, and they've been also receiving bevacizumab, do we need to stop the bevacizumab, or can we continue the bevacizumab and change the chemotherapy drugs that we are using? And what this latest research has shown, that patients can continue to have benefit if we continue the bevacizumab. And so that what that means, that this target, this anti-angiogenesis approach, is something that we can continue to use throughout a course of a person's illness. Another clinical trial looked at a somewhat related drug to bevacizumab referred to as aflibercept, and that trial also demonstrated that patients can benefit from this anti-angiogenesis approach when combined with chemotherapy. And the final study was with a drug called regorafenib. This is a pill. It's referred to as a multi-kinase inhibitor, and it also affects this anti-angiogenesis type pathway. This clinical trial included patients who had shown evidence of disease progression despite receiving bevacizumab and all the chemotherapy drugs, and this trial showed that people could get further benefit when they received regorafenib, and that led to FDA approval this year of yet another new drug for patients with metastatic disease. So what I attempted to do in this very brief amount of time is just to focus on a few critical highlights, and perhaps when there are questions, we can focus on some other issues. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Benson, for just an excellent overview of colorectal cancer and a lot of the treatment options and for things that people need to be aware of. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Eunice Kwok. And Dr. Kwok is Instructor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Assistant in Medicine, Hematology Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Kwok is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, practical tips to manage side effects and pain, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Kwok.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. What I'll talk about, first of all, is just to maybe take a step back about clinical trials. Dr. Benson has already mentioned that there have been some very important clinical trials that have been presented this year that have changed the way that we treat colon cancer. The clinical trials fall into several different categories, and the categories include phase 1 trials, phase 2 trials, and phase 3 trials. Phase 1 trials are really the very first arena where new drugs are being developed, where drugs are being developed from a company and being put into trials involving people, as opposed to laboratory research. And so this is really the first opportunity where new drugs, be those chemotherapies or targeted agents, are having an experience in people, and where we are learning how the drugs affect people in terms of side effects and what kind of doses of the drugs should be given in terms of the side effects that are produced, what kinds of doses can be tolerated, and on what kind of treatment schedules. Phase 2 trials are trials where a drug has been through the phase 1 testing process, and the drugs have been studied to the point where there is some sense of knowing what the appropriate dose of a drug is, and then patients with a particular type of disease are treated to see if there's any evidence of efficacy of the drug in that disease. If a drug is successful in the phase 2 setting, it may go on to phase 3 testing, where the drug is then compared in patients to see whether patients who receive the study drug do better, the same, or less well than patients who receive the standard of care. And so phase 3 trials are really the arena where our new standard of cares are being determined. There are also variations of these trials, but the basic organization of how trials are performed includes phase 1 trials, phase 2 trials, and phase 3 trials. Clinical trials are something that is voluntary. A participant in a trial has the ability to consider a trial or even decide to not participate in a trial. But there are certain eligibility requirements that are required for clinical trial participation. So some trials require people to have a specific disease or a specific stage of disease. Some trials require that people have certain criteria in regards to their general health, in regards to other medical problems, or certain laboratory values such as liver function tests. And in order to be a participant in those trials, one would have to meet those eligibility criteria. The benefits of being in the clinical trial include that for certain new drugs, particularly targeted agents or drugs that are being used initially in the setting of advanced cancer, it's really the opportunity to get potential exposure to these new therapies before they become widely available. And because all the drugs that we use routinely in standard care have been through phase one testing, the hope is that phase one clinical trials could be a setting where new effective therapies could be accessed before the drugs are brought to market, generally speaking. When people are involved in clinical trials, people undergoing clinical trial therapy are followed very closely by their providers. And so clinical trial participation allows patients to have a very close relationship with their caregivers and very close follow-up, and an opportunity as well to potentially benefit themselves, but also potentially benefit others in the future. Being in a clinical trial certainly has some downsides. Some of the downsides include that treatments, any drugs, have potential side effects. And in the setting of a clinical trial, particularly in an early phase clinical trial, like a phase one trial or even in a phase two trial, some of those potential side effects are not entirely known. And some of the side effects are only being discovered through more and more patients receiving those drugs. And the side effects could potentially be even dangerous, and providers would be monitoring patients very closely for the possibility that those side effects might be harmful. It's also possible that the treatments might not work as well as even the standard of care. So, for instance, in a phase three trial, it may be that the drug under investigation doesn't work as well as what is already considered the standard of care. In some settings, the drugs may not have any activity at all. For instance, in the phase one or phase two setting, we're still trying to figure out whether a drug has any ability to impact the course of someone's disease. And so that's really only over time and having more patients receive the drug that we learn these kinds of pieces of information. In phase three trials, sometimes there are situations, in particular in phase three trials, although sometimes in phase two trials, there may be times when a participant in the trial is not actually getting the drug that's being studied, but they might be getting a placebo. And sometimes one doesn't know when one is receiving the placebo. So that's another potential downside of being in a clinical trial. But generally speaking, I think clinical trials are really the way that we learn more about how to treat cancer, how we learn what therapies can benefit patients, what therapies could potentially improve upon what we're currently using in terms of risk of side effects as well as efficacy. And in terms of early phase clinical trials, I think that is really the realm where we're very excited about some of the newer targeted therapies similar to what Dr. Benson had spoken about, because really the move in drug development recently has been towards better understanding of the biologic pathways that are important in individuals' cancer cells and trying to target those pathways that are particularly important for a cancer cell's growth by choosing the right targeted therapies for the best chance of effectiveness. I think that, again, clinical trials are really how we move forward for any one particular person in the course of the clinical trial process. Certainly we hope that they will benefit, but really over time is how we learn to build globally on our treatment options for patients. And I would encourage clinical trial participation for that reason. Now moving on to side effects of therapy. Certainly chemotherapies have side effects. Targeted therapies also have side effects. And I think the key to managing the side effects that one encounters with any kind of therapy is to be in very close communication with one's oncologist and one's care team in general. I think that if patients can understand that side effects, we can manage side effects effectively and are more likely to be able to manage side effects effectively if we can act upon them sooner rather than later, then it's a much more smooth process for both the patient receiving therapy as well as for the providers who are trying to manage the symptoms. And so I would encourage everyone to really feel very comfortable about staying in close communication with their providers about any side effects that they're concerned about. I think that's really the key for the most effective management of symptoms. For chemotherapy in general, of course, side effects like fatigue, bone marrow suppression, and in the case of oxaliplatin neuropathy, these can be bothersome problems. Neuropathy can even be a long-standing side effect that people experience over years. We do often use calcium and magnesium infusions in attempts to try to decrease the severity of those long-term neuropathy or numbness and tingling side effects of oxaliplatin. So that is something that one can consider in the course of receiving therapies such as FOLFOX, the oxaliplatin-containing regimens. As far as bowel control, diarrhea certainly can be a side effect of chemotherapy, but I find that oftentimes it's just the opposite problem that people are experiencing, which is constipation. And I think the constipation often becomes the problem soon after the infusion because of the Zofran or ondansetron that people are receiving, some of the anti-nausea medications that can really cause a lot of constipation. And so it can be a real challenge to try to balance the issues of managing one's constipation with managing the potential for diarrhea that may occur further down in the course of therapy as one gets farther away from their ondansetron usage. Fatigue can be a very difficult problem for people to manage and to live with. And I think that certainly because chemotherapies can cause anemia or decreases in red counts, there is the potential for people to become fatigued just on that basis alone. But in addition, I think that chemotherapy causes a general fatigue, which is sometimes very difficult to manage. And I think it's important for patients to realize that it's okay to take it easy, to listen to one's body, and to really give oneself the ability to manage and heal from the side effects of the chemotherapy through each treatment cycle. There can be medications that are provided, such as methylphenidate or Ritalin. Sometimes that can help people to feel a better sense of energy so that they can get through the majority of their day with a sense of being more functional. There are other medications that can also provide some degree of stimulus so that people can feel more alert during the course of their therapy. As far as pain control, certainly problems with fatigue, sedation can be the result of not just chemotherapy, but some of the medications we use for pain control. Certainly narcotics or opioids can have many side effects in and of themselves, even though they're being used to treat a side effect of one's disease. The pain medications can cause constipation and sedation, and those also can be very challenging to manage. I think that really one aspect of care that I have found very useful is to involve the assistance of a palliative care team, which at least in our hospital is a group of physicians, nurse practitioners, and other care providers who are really experts in pain management, experts in side effect management, experts in symptom management, generally speaking. I think that their involvement in patient care has been invaluable in terms of helping us as oncologists learn to better manage pain for any one individual, manage nausea, manage fatigue. And in fact, in the setting of advanced cancer with metastatic lung cancer, for instance, there has been a study that has shown that the early involvement of palliative care into a patient's course of therapy actually let people live longer. So I think that there is a lot to be gained by focusing on symptom management, and not even just symptom management, but trying to focus on the whole person and bringing that aspect of care into a patient's medical treatment. Again, communication with a healthcare team about side effects of therapy is very important. It's really crucial to helping everyone get through the treatment in a way where their quality of life can be preserved. But I think that there are general quality of life issues in terms of being on chemotherapy, whether that be after a surgical procedure or whether that be in the setting of advanced cancer. Again, while we are always trying to be aggressive about how we treat patients' cancer, I think that it's important to be very cognizant of quality of life. And the tendency, I think, is for patients and practitioners to perhaps overlook the issues of quality of life and maybe not speak to those directly as often as would be helpful for both parties. And so I would encourage both providers and patients to address those issues that are of concern to them in terms of side effects of therapy, side effects of disease, and how those issues affect one's quality of life. With those comments, I think I will conclude and pass off to the next topic.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Kwok, for just really an excellent presentation and for really covering in great detail both in terms of the clinical trial process but also in terms of the management of side effects, which I know there'll be questions about during the Q&A, and you're stressing the importance of that communication with the healthcare team. So I want to thank you for that and the role of the palliative care team as well. So I know there'll be questions about this during the Q&A, so thank you very much. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden. And Diana is a dietitian by training. She's a supervisor of clinical nutrition, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to discuss some of the common side effects and management suggestions related to nutrition with you all today. So to start with, during treatment, the goal is, we're talking from a nutrition's perspective, to eat the best diet possible within the constraints of side effect management. Some suggestions to accomplish this are to eat, in general, small, frequent meals, plan meals and snacks the day before, stay well hydrated by drinking plenty of decaffeinated fluids, and consume adequate protein. And some examples of good protein sources are from our meat and our dairy products. one thing that sometimes is overlooked is to stay as active as you can. Activity can not only help with bowel management and the digestion, but it can also help a little bit with appetite. So whatever you are allowed to do as far as what your physician and medical or the medical team has allowed for you to be active and what activities they're okay with you participating in, to do those as you tolerate them. So some of the common side effects that are experienced are things like nausea and vomiting, decreased appetite, taste changes, mouth sores, and diarrhea. And I want to speak just briefly on each one of these and things that may be helpful for you to consider to help alleviate some of these side effects or at least minimize them. So first off, when we look at nausea and vomiting or a reduction in your appetite or a feeling of fullness that can happen a lot, one thing you can try and do is eliminate offending odors. So a lot of times warm foods or hot foods will turn patients off more quickly than foods that are served at room temperature or cold because the odors are more intensified. So if you're nauseous or you don't have a good appetite, it may be worthwhile trying some room temperature or cold foods. Dry crackers and toast are another suggestion that we provide patients who are maybe experiencing nausea. This basically is to help keep something on your stomach, and even by your bedside before you get up in the morning, a lot of times we'll take medications and we're not very hungry, and sometimes those medications can irritate our stomach, and so having a little something on your stomach when you go to take medications or before you get up from the sitting position or lying down position can help alleviate some of that feeling of nausea. Other foods that we encourage patients to avoid or reduce the consumption of are foods that are overly sweet, that are greasy or fried, or highly spiced. If you're experiencing nausea and vomiting or a reduction in your appetite or the feeling of fullness, these foods can either amplify those side effects or not help reduce them. So just to think about when you go to eat and what you're planning your meals to be, that you consider eliminating some of those from your plan. Good oral care is important as well. Brushing teeth, keeping that addressed can not only help with taste, but it can help reduce other issues as well. And try and be relaxed as often as possible when you are eating. Don't wear tightly fitting clothing. Don't rush when you're eating. Try to have time to really sit there, chew your food, and pay attention to what you're actually eating so that you're aware that you're getting the allotted amount that you've, had for yourself that day in. Sometimes medication can be beneficial. And this is where you need to talk with the healthcare team. But depending on the source of your poor appetite or decreased intake, sometimes medications might be helpful. But there are some contraindications to these, so you do need to have a healthcare team review your plan of care and medication list. Another common side effect that can happen are changes in the taste. And like I mentioned earlier, keeping good oral care is important. You can rinse your mouth with baking soda and water, or you can just rinse it with water. Some of the common taste changes patients experience are a metallic flavor, and we encourage patients to focus on utilizing plastic utensilware or drinking from actual glass instead of a can. Or through a straw, and to enhance flavored foods, sometimes tart is an option, and patients sometimes do well with tart-tasting foods. It's something they can pick up on, and it tastes like it's supposed to taste. So pickles, lemons, things that have been in vinegar, and then trying new foods that you haven't had that you don't commonly eat or that you haven't had in a while, a lot of times those may taste good again. So don't close the door to things that in the past haven't tasted like you'd prefer them to. Another common side effect are mouth sores. And this is, there's multiple reasons patients can experience these, and medication is often used to help with eliminating some of the pain and discomfort. But what you can do nutritionally is be sure to choose soft, moist foods that are easy to swallow, that aren't going to be pointy or are rough in your mouth. And you also want to avoid acidic or tart and spicy foods. This could irritate your mouth as well. If your food is needing to be cut because you aren't able to just manipulate it with a fork, for example, be sure to cut them into very small bites or even consider pureeing some of your food items. At times, it may be appropriate to try a supplemental drink or fixing your own shake or smoothie sort of fortified drink option. You want to be sure to stay nice and hydrated, and drinking decaffeinated fluids, are something to focus on. Water is the best hydrant, and so drinking water is one of the best options that we recommend for patients. Diarrhea is another side effect patients experience at times, and sometimes it can be addressed by adjusting the fiber in the diet, the type of fiber that the patient's consuming. We also have patients examine if they're doing a lot of sugar-free items because the sugar alcohol could aggravate this. And just the amount of sweetened foods in general in our diet can result in diarrhea. So when we look at diarrhea, there's a lot of reasons why patients might experience diarrhea, and so really pinpointing the source of that is the key to it, but some diet modifications might be beneficial. Another thing to do is to help manage is with constipation. If patients are having or experiencing constipation, like I mentioned earlier, physical activity can be beneficial if it's within the appropriate realms of your care. And then staying hydrated. Dehydration along with medications can result and other reasons as well, in constipation. So hydration is one thing, is from a dietitian's perspective, we always look at as an option to help with this. And then, of course, looking at their medication, the patient's medication record, to see if there are any medications that may be contributing to this side effect. So I think this concludes my remarks, and I'm going to hand this back over to Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Diana. That was a wonderful presentation and a lot of very helpful tips, because actually nutrition, hydration, these are areas that often trip people up. They don't quite know what to do, and you're giving this advice is so helpful, so, and recommendations. Thank you. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. And Elizabeth, or Liz, is actually, she's an oncology social worker, a colleague of mine at Cancer Care. She's program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra is going to address the review of our free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. And also she's going to talk to you about the colorectal cancer support groups that she facilitates here at Cancer Care. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague and friend, Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situations or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers people with colorectal cancer support group over the telephone as well as online groups for people with colorectal cancer and their caregivers. We also have unique young adult caregiver groups, and for certainly for some people between the ages of 20 and 40, that's a nice group to be able to discuss certain very special obstacles. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you will need to receive. As we have learned a lot from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. All those new treatments that Dr. Benson discussed, that's a lot to really talk to your individual doctors about to see whether they would be beneficial to you. And our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you very much, Liz, for just really so wonderfully presenting the services of Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, please call our Cancer Care main number at 1-800-813-HOPE. I'll repeat that number again as we conclude the program as well. But for now, let's try to see if we can take as many questions as we can. And Sam, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions? And we'll let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
And we actually have a question from one of our online participants. And the question is from Janet. Regarding adjusting fiber for treatment of diarrhea in these patients, would you be adding fiber such as Metamucil or reducing fiber as in whole grains and fruits and vegetables? Could you address that, Diana?
Sure. So things we would say to reduce is insoluble fiber more so. And, I mean, excuse me, this is constipation. Carolyn, is that correct?
No, actually, regarding adjusting fiber, I'll repeat the question. Regarding adjusting fiber for treatment of diarrhea.
Oh, diarrhea. Thank you.
Would you be adding fiber such as Metamucil or reducing fiber as in whole grains and fruits and vegetables?
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for that. You can go, when you have diarrhea, what you want to do is slow down your system. So there are two types of fiber. There's an insoluble fiber that's commonly found in Metamucil and our fruits and vegetables and breads and grains. And then the other type of fiber is a soluble fiber. And so soluble fiber is something that can help with bowel regularity. So if you are having constipation, for example, you could take Metamucil and do the full 8 ounces of water that's recommended, and that would help with motility and kind of regularity. But if you're trying to address diarrhea, depending on the root cause of the diarrhea, now that's really what you want to hone in on, is why are you having diarrhea? Is it because you're having radiation and there's inflammation? Is it because of chemotherapy? Is it because of you've been on antibiotics and you may need to consider, like a lactobacillus or some other sort of probiotic to help reactivate those cultures in your system? It really depends. But in general, we want to slow down the system. So if you were taking Metamucil, you could reduce the amount of water with that. And the fiber, it's called soluble fiber, when it got into your system, it would basically pull water from your GI tract and help slow that motility more, so it acts more like a sponge. Insoluble fiber is fiber like in celery. You can cook celery for hours and hours, and it still looks like celery. That's also a bulking agent, but it's also a motility agent. So a lot of times we're reducing that type of fiber, because it can cause some irritation. If you're having diarrhea, depending, like I said, on the source of it, that would be one of the fibers we would hold back on potentially, and then focus more on the soluble fiber and modifying how that could be provided. It really depends, again, on how much diarrhea you're having and what the actual reason you're having the diarrhea. But, that's where working with your healthcare team to really individualize your care is beneficial. At times medications are something we can modify. Sometimes it goes further into the diet, but like again, it's just the actual cause of the diarrhea.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And we have a question for one of our online participants. Actually, perhaps Dasha Benson, if you could take this. It asks about the FDA approval of Zaltrap for metastatic colorectal cancer. Do you find this drug effective? Can you comment on that, Dr. Benson?
Well, we do have the necessary data from a randomized clinical trial, and in this particular trial, which was reviewed by the FDA and led to the approval, this included patients who had previous therapy with or without bevacizumab, but with an oxaliplatin-based treatment. And then when patients had evidence that their tumor was not responding and progressing from that oxaliplatin program, they were eligible for this clinical trial. And the trial compared an alternative chemotherapy schedule, which was based around the drug irinotecan, with or without the ziv aflibercept. And what the study showed is that by adding ziv aflibercept, people had a longer interval of time before they progressed compared to those who did not get the ziv aflibercept. There was also an increase in side effects when the ziv aflibercept was added. So based on this evidence, it was appropriate to include a ziv aflibercept regimen in guidelines. Now, having said that, we're not expecting widespread use in the United States, because many, many people in the United States first receive their oxaliplatin-based treatment with bevacizumab. And as I mentioned, there are now data that if people progress on that program, they can go into a second treatment program with different chemotherapy, but continuation of the bevacizumab. And I think that's what most oncologists would recommend, rather than switching to ziv aflibercept, because first of all, for patients in that setting, you'll clearly know what the benefit, or at least the tolerability of the bevacizumab is, and so you're more comfortable continuing it with another chemotherapy program. And in fact, the results are very similar when you do that compared to ziv aflibercept. And if there are indeed more side effects with Ziv aflibercept, there would really not be a strong argument to switch to that drug. Now, the FDA indication is only for people who've progressed after their first therapy and receive irinotecan and Ziv aflibercept. We do not know if it's useful in any other indication and not recommended. So in summary, I suspect the majority of people who are candidates for an anti-angiogenesis type approach will not be receiving this drug.
Thank you. And I have another question actually from one of our online participants, actually for Dr. Kwok. It's a question that hasn't come up before. So it's about molecular markers regarding treatment decisions in palliative therapy for colorectal cancer. Can you comment on that? Or?
Sure. So in the setting of advanced disease where we're really treating to help manage the disease and control the disease for as long as possible but are not anticipating curing the disease, there has been a lot of investigation of drugs that are targeted towards particular molecules or proteins or biomarkers that may be specific to an individual's tumor. For instance, in phase one clinical trials, even though phase one clinical trials have traditionally been the realm where new drugs are being studied and there's really not much of a clear expectation of efficacy because really we're trying to learn about the drugs and how the drugs affect people and how people affect drugs, really, how the drugs are metabolized. The phase one trials these days are really becoming very honed in on specific biomarkers or genetic changes, protein abnormalities that can really only be determined by testing an individual's tumor, and then that sometimes actually has been part of determining eligibility for a particular trial, particularly if the trial involves a drug that is a targeted agent. So I think that the excitement around molecular markers for determining therapy really has been building over the course of the past 5-7 years. There have been some really remarkable successes, particularly in diseases like lung cancer and melanoma, and to some degree in colorectal cancer, because now we do use KRAS as a marker for determining whether or not we use an EGFR inhibitor. But even in the setting, really I think the findings that we learn in the palliative setting, for instance, in clinical trials or even outside of clinical trials, those successes can maybe one day even be generalized to the setting of curable disease adjuvant treatment. And only time will tell, but I think biomarkers are certainly an exciting avenue of treatment and research.
Well, thank you very much. It's really excellent. And one other question that's come up, actually, is just in terms of early detection. So the questions really are, and Josh and Dr. Kwok, if you could answer this as well, do polyps increase colon cancer risk? And then what about alcohol increase colon cancer risk and exercise preventing colon cancer risk? So if you just say a word about that as well as we conclude.
Well, as far as polyps go, polyps are really sort of depends on the type of polyps, but generally speaking, adenomatous polyps, for instance, are really the precursor lesions that over time can develop into colon cancers. And that's why there is such a focus on trying to prevent cancers, because you can detect polyps at an early stage, have them removed, and then you can remove risk of colon cancer development from that particular polyp, and really you can only, or I should say, you can best do that by undergoing colonoscopy. So generally speaking, yes, polyps are not in and of themselves cancers, but they are potentially the precursors to cancers, and so one would want to have those addressed in order to reduce one's chances of developing colorectal cancer. how long it takes for a polyp to become a cancer has sort of historically or classically been thought of as a multi-year process, perhaps going from an early polyp to a cancer over the course of something like 10 years, but I think that's highly variable, and some polyps can become cancers much more quickly than that. As far as alcohol intake, exercise, diet in general, Dr. Benson may be able to address this as well, but I think that overall having good general health is important for having good health during the course of one's treatment, whether that be in the adjuvant setting or in the palliative setting. And so maintaining an exercise regimen that is doable for any individual, I think, helps not only overall function but also mood. And alcohol is something that would be used in great moderation. Perhaps Dr. Benson would like to further comment.
Well, I mean, I would agree that the most optimal situation for an individual under treatment is to have a highly functional status. It's what we refer to as performance status. And what we found in terms of performance status, not only is it far easier for individuals to undergo surgery, but also the tolerance of chemotherapy and even the benefits of chemotherapy tend to be best the better the functional status of an individual. So for people who have what we refer to as comorbidities, so other medical problems, it can make it much more difficult to offer certain components of a treatment program. And during therapy, we certainly want to maintain good performance status and quality of life. So we have to put a great deal of emphasis not only on managing side effects, but encouraging people to get exercise and to ingest sufficient numbers of calories and to keep well hydrated, because by doing so, that can not only improve quality of life, but improve tolerance overall for the therapy. So we want patients to maintain their conditioning.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've been outstanding. And I want to thank all of you who've both asked these questions online, wonderful questions, and that's really enhanced our call. I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour program, and that in planning this program we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I want you to feel free to contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE to speak to our oncology social workers. If you have any questions that you didn't get to ask, please call us. And most importantly, as we conclude the call, I just want to reiterate what Liz said. We don't want any one of you to feel you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're here to help you. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.